The Monologue.
Jedi is the police dog with the Seattle Police Department that was stabbed to death by a reported burglar. Someone who attempted to break into a home in South Seattle, armed with both a knife and a machete. Cops responded. They end up utilizing the police dog Jedi to get control of a situation that seemed pretty clear was going to quickly deteriorate, because despite their best efforts, officers ask this unidentified suspect, the only identity we have on him is a male Hispanic. He was wearing nothing but a bathroom towel, and he was not listening to police. He was going towards oncoming traffic. He posed a serious threat because at one point, according to the body cam footage that I saw, he kind of goes towards an officer with the knife before turning away. We didn't know how this was going to end. And so having the cops to go in there to try to neutralize this guy was not necessarily safe. So they ended up using Jedi as a way to try to safely and protect the humans, but to try to safely go after and neutralize the suspect. It did not go so well for the dog or the man, the suspect. And it was hard to watch.
Do Sam, pick it up. I need containment from the precinct side. We got one running with a machete. Drop it.
Fuses.
Drop it now, Seattle Police.
They're still chasing him.
Do Sam, I need someone from the precinct side, quick. Stop now.
Guy's going towards incoming traffic.
Do it now. Get on the ground.
Still refusing.
To Sam, block traffic from the precinct side. What do you want to do?
I'm going to send the dog.
Okay.
I'm going to send the dog, or he's going to get shot, though. So they send in the dog, and this is part of the body cam footage. It's out there. You shouldn't watch it, honestly. I did because I had to report on this story, and I wanted to make sure I had an understanding of what actually happened. I mean, it's difficult to watch. It kept me up after I watched it. You see the man hacking at the dog with the machete and then stabbing it multiple times. And what is particularly heartbreaking is that even after that, the dog didn't just immediately collapse. The dog still was focused on the suspect, as Jedi was trained to do. But unfortunately, Jedi ends up getting such significant injuries that he dies. The suspect also died because as the suspect was attacking the police dog, officers went in and the guy attacks one of the officers who grabs his face, as you see on the body cam footage. They shoot him and he dies. This didn't have to happen, but thanks to a law that was passed last year by the Democrats, who have total control of the state legislature, they banned non-lethal weapons of a certain caliber size, like the 40 millimeter caliber size. The 40 millimeter launcher that could have been used basically has rubber bullets, or sponge bullets at the side, at the top. It could have been used from afar without having to get close to the guy with the machete and the other knife. But unfortunately, SPD officers don't carry them very much anymore because they were banned by the state legislature. Now, Democrats would say, first, well, they're saying two different things. On the one hand, they're saying, oh, you're misinterpreting the law. That's not what the law says. The law very clearly says that it's banned. And then you've got other Democrats like Roger Goodman, a state representative Democrat from Kirkland, taking the position of, oh, no, you should just don't worry. You should continue to use the non-lethal weapons. We'll fix it. But of course, that's not how the law works. If an officer were to use a 40 millimeter launcher and the suspect like leans into it inadvertently and it ends up creating a brain bleed and the person dies or gets seriously injured, that cop goes to jail. And there are SPD officers who don't think the command staff will have their backs. This was preventable. But unfortunately, a canine unit is dead because Democrats wanted to reimagine policing in a way that, of course, ends up making everyone more dangerous. Our lives are more dangerous as a result. Our communities are more dangerous as a result. If you want to read more about this story, I've got it up. Text the keyword RANTS, R-A-N-T-Z, to 1-800-465-8770. 1-800-465-8770. It's just absolutely tragic. And I'm disgusted that Democrats have allowed this to happen.
The interview.
Interesting news coming out of Snohomish County, where Councilmember Sam Lowe is launching his campaign to take on a fellow Republican, State Representative Robert Sutherland. Joining me on the line is Snohomish County Councilmember Sam Lowe. Welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon, Jason. Thanks for having me on today.
So you're looking to make the jump from the county council to become a state representative. You're going up against a Republican. Why did you decide to take him on?
You know, I hadn't actually thought about running for state representative until the redistricting process. And during the redistricting process in November, I changed from the 44th district into the 39th district. And I sat down and looked at the map, and I realized the 39th district, 50% of the voters are new voters to the district. And so I looked at it. It's a new district. Includes Lake Stevens, which is the largest city in the district, a city where I live. And after looking at it, I thought I'd be the best fit to run for the position.
Now, it's being framed by the Everett Herald as you taking on Robert Sutherland, who is they say, embraced Donald Trump's false claims of widespread election fraud, and that it has cost him some support amongst the moderates in the Republican Party. Did that factor at all into your decision?
You know, honestly, I've run at the city level, I've run at the county level, and now I'm going to start running at the state level. I've always run on my record and who I am, and obviously I'm a Republican. My opponent's a Republican, and I have my record. He has his record, and I think the voters should choose who they want to represent them based on their priorities and their experience. And so that's a great question for him.
What about your record do you believe makes you better suited for this role than the incumbent?
Well, first of all, my platform has always been transportation, working on the trestle, working on 522, working on Highway 2. That's something that my constituents deal with on a daily basis. And I believe they want a representative that's going to focus on transportation, focus on broadband issues. Those are two of the big ones. And of course, public safety. All three of those are issues that are extremely important, and I think those are the three most important things for my constituents to put their trust in and somebody to represent them.
Well, especially on transportation. Now, obviously, as a council member on the county council, you've dealt significantly with traffic going through Monroe and going into to Sultan. Those cities have now shifted as well, right? I mean, Monroe and I believe Sultan into Gold Bar, they have moved districts as well, right? I mean, you would not represent them.
So that is correct, that Monroe and Gold Bar and even Arlington are no longer in the 39th district. But part of Sultan is still in the district. The area where Carolyn Eslick, Representative Eslick, lives is still in the district. And so, yes, that part of it is still there.
Will you hold both positions? Would you stay on the council if you were elected to the state house?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I want to be totally up front. I'm running to keep my county council seat and state representative seat. And so the voters will have that decision to make when they choose if they want my opponent or I. They'll know exactly where I stand, and they'll know exactly where my opponent stands.
Yeah, and by the way, that's not unheard of to hold both positions like that. Just real quickly, as obviously today is the start of the legislative session, a big issue is on emergency powers, fixing the anti-police bills. You know, the focus on transportation from you obviously is incredibly important for the region, but very quickly, where do you stand on both of those issues if you were, say, a state representative right now?
Well, I think that both of those are at the forefront. Police reform is extremely talked about in Olympia. Councilmember Nehring and I And the sheriff Courtney has sent off a letter today to our representatives on police reform. We definitely want to see some of the mistakes that were passed last year fixed and addressed. Those are important. I think another one that's really important is the long-term care. This tax that was that nobody's really shed a light on, and now the light is being shined on it and how much it's going to cost taxpayers. And that's something that needs to be tabled and back to the drawing board, because clearly it doesn't work, and the governors had to come out and say, hey, we're not even going to collect the money for that, because clearly they realize it's a mistake.
Yeah, it's absolute nonsense. We've been talking with Snohomish County Councilmember Sam Lowe, who hopes to also hold the title of State Representative Sam Lowe, making it his announcement for his campaign today. Thank you so much for stopping by. Obviously, as we get into the swing of the election season, we'll be having you on way more to talk about some of the issues. As always, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks, Jason. Have a great afternoon.
You as well. Now this.
The monologue.
Well, there's finally some pushback, some significant pushback, and we can't say that we're shocked, but pushback against the teachers' unions for choosing to go remote learning instead of reopening the schools or keeping the schools open despite the spread of Omicron. We know that Omicron has very little impact on kids. No matter what Justice Sonia Mayor might say, we know that kids are barely impacted by COVID. They can get COVID. There's no doubt about it. But they are not at risk in general to COVID unless they've got some sort of underlying health condition that is quite serious. In fact, I played some of the audio a little bit earlier where the CDC director, Dr. Shel Walensky, acknowledged that the folks who were hit the hardest, killed, dead, as a result, had four or more comorbidities, at least. That's something like 75%. And so now we've got schools that are getting closed, and more and more and more parents, lawmakers, public health officials are coming out in favor of keeping them open. And we're seeing, for the first time in a long time, Democrats going after the unions pretty hard. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot, for example, as we're in day four of the illegal walkout, the shutdown of these schools, she was on Meet the Press, and she just ripped in to the teachers and the teachers' union.
And to be clear, what the Chicago Teachers' Union did was an illegal walkout. They abandoned their posts and they abandoned kids and their families. We are working diligently every single day at the bargaining table to narrow the differences and to get a deal done. My team has been working every single day. They're back at it again here Sunday. They were at it yesterday. And we can get a deal done if there's goodwill on both sides.
But there isn't goodwill on both sides. I think there's goodwill, I suppose, coming from Lori Lightfoot, but not from the teachers' unions, who are pretending they didn't get billions of dollars in funding all across the country to go to making the schools as safe as these teachers' unions demanded. Now, even before having to change all of the schools and, you know, the HVAC systems and whatnot, the schools were safe. And we knew this early on that kids are barely impacted. But we still offered money. We, Democrats, gave money to the unions and the schools to do what? Where'd the money go? And what is this really about? This is about a lifestyle for teachers who like the idea of working from home. And they are going to sit this out until the surge goes down. And that could take 2 weeks. We expect that the surge, which is already on the decline, will end in about 2 weeks. Or we've already peaked, and now we're going to go down in the next 2 weeks. We'll continue to see it go down to, you know, what's deemed quote unquote manageable levels, even though, again, kids aren't being impacted by COVID in the same way. Now, I don't know if Lori Lightfoot is going after the unions because she believes what they're doing is wrong, or if she's going after the unions because Democrats realize that the tide is turning, that the voters, who have, for the most part, given deferential treatment to the unions, even when they disagree with the move the unions take, they're starting to change. In the past, they used to say, hey, for the most part, voters would say, unions, do what you do. We're going to support you. We're going to be blindly loyal because, you know, teachers are heroes. They're taking on very noble professions, and they're dealing with kids like my own, kind of a brat. I can't imagine what it'd be like to deal with brats dozens at a time every single day for a job. So they've given some deference to teachers. But now things have changed because it's very clear that kids are worse off as a result of staying home than they would be going to school and even getting COVID. But as former CDC Director Robert Redfield told meet the press as well, that schools are the safest place for kids.
Well, I've said this before. I think the schools are really the safest place for our K through 12s to be. It's imperative to keep them open. There's no equivalency to virtual learning. The public health interest of these kids is to be in face-to-face learning. I've mentioned before, many kids get their nutritional support in school. Over 7 million kids get mental health services. We're obviously an important vehicle for understanding child abuse, not to mention just the loneliness factor and the potential for depression, suicide, drug abuse.
And that part is so important to underscore. You've got kids sitting in front of a screen for 6-7 hours a day, and they're getting depressed. They're getting suicidal. They're not seeing their friends. They're not getting back to life as normal. And having to deal with that last year only to get just a little bit of a taste of freedom again, or what they view as freedom, which ironically means going back into the classroom, taking that away is just cruel. And these teachers are choosing to be cruel to the kids that they tell us over and over and over again they truly care about. But they like the lifestyle of working from home, even if it means hurting your kids.
The interview.
Well, over a year after telling us that he would be able to handle and eradicate COVID, all of a sudden, President Joe Biden and his administration doing an about-face on a lot of the talking points that they previously pretended were legitimate. Joining me on the line, RNC Rapid Response Director Tommy Pigott. Tommy, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So we went from getting rid of the virus completely to, well, you're going to have to live with it and we can mitigate it. And by the way, it's not so bad because look at the number of people who are dying. It turns out a lot of them had comorbidities and maybe it wasn't COVID at all. So everything that we kind of been saying that Republicans knew and messaged a year ago, all of a sudden he's adopting them.
Well, I think it goes to show how dishonest he really was. I think this is a point that the mainstream media is missing a lot with how they're approaching this, is that Joe Biden dishonestly said he would shut down the virus. That is his direct quote. He went out there during the campaign. He played politics with the virus. He promised he had some mythical plan that would solve this problem, but that just wasn't the truth. No one thought it was the truth at the time. People were saying it wasn't the truth. And now that he's president, he's realizing that he can't live up to this promise because it was never possible. So to your point, he's now shifting his messaging, but he can't really, I don't think we should let him escape from his standard. He was the one that established the standard of shutting down the virus. He was the one that said that President Trump was unfit to be president, which again was his phrasing, because of this. So we need to hold him to the exact same standard he held President Trump and hold him responsible for his lies on COVID.
Well, the RNC will and some media outlets will, but for the most part, the media outlets that exist won't, right? I mean, CNN's not going to do this. They're doing an about face as well.
I think you're right that it falls a lot on the RNC and other outlets to make sure, you know, to make sure that we're holding Biden accountable. And that's what we're doing every single day. We're out shouting from the rooftops, pointing out his hypocrisy, pointing out past clips. But I think Americans across the board, and even on CNN, for example, you're seeing people really starting to raise their eyebrows at the thing that the CDC is saying, the way that their guidance seems so haphazard and almost responsive to the left on Twitter. You see even on these liberal publications and outlets questioning what is going on, because he didn't shy away from this promise during the campaign. He said it over and over again. So the American people can see with their own eyes. He said one thing and the opposite has happened. And so I think no matter how he tries to run away from it, I think it's going to come back and the voters are going to hold him responsible and Democrats responsible in 2022.
Well, that's the most important part in all of this, because, you know, to your point, yes, there are some media members that are starting to call this out, but they're all like Jennifer Rubin from The Washington Post, who takes the polar opposite position all of a sudden as to what she said when Trump was in office. This is really going to be about the voters. And do you believe at the end of the day, based on what's going on, the voters will be able to sort of cut through some of the messaging coming from most mainstream media outlets outside of, say, Fox News?
I think they will. And I think we're actually seeing that being already reflected in the polling. COVID was really his last issue where he was above water, really across the board. Everywhere else, Americans were giving him higher disapproval marks than approval. And just over the holidays, that switched. And so now you're seeing that on COVID as well, more Americans disapprove than approve of Biden's handling of COVID-19 because they're seeing the impacts in their real lives. And I am confident that the Americans will see through the spin, because just think about every other issue that Biden's tried to deflect on, from Afghanistan, the border, inflation. The American people see the results with their own eyes, and they see it now with COVID. So I am confident they'll see the truth.
It's just such odd strategy coming from the Biden administration, where it'd be one thing if YouTube didn't exist and we didn't have 24/7 cable outlets and, you know, people weren't focused on how it's all impacting them directly. Inflation wasn't happening before it was, but don't worry, it's transitory before, okay, no, it's going to last for a little bit longer, probably for the next couple years, but it might get a little bit better. There's nothing going on at the border. There's no crisis whatsoever, despite the fact that we had all of this video. Issue after issue, they just continue. And last week, the jobs report, it was a disaster, but he was bragging about it. It is absurd to me, and I do not understand, just from a strategy perspective, because this is what you're involved in on the RNC side. What can you make sense of it very quickly, 40 seconds?
I honestly can't, and I think you had to summarize it. He's not even trying to say that the problems are someone else's fault. He's denying that they exist at all. So I think he's relying on gaslighting to the extreme, and it's not going to work. I honestly have been scratching my head myself. But he keeps on doing it, and I don't really know why.
Yeah, it's so bizarre. I honestly don't understand. We've been talking with RNC Rapid Response Director Tommy Pigott. Tommy, thank you so much, as always, for stopping by. Really appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rant Show. Now this.
The Jason Rant Show.
Jason Rantz has followed that into Taylor's radio host in Seattle. He broke the story and joins us now.
Never shy of his opinion, Jason. Definitely letting you know how he feels about that.
Wow. You laid that down.
Long Form, presented by Northgate Rare Coins and Precious Metals.
Through no fault of her own, she is out of a job. Mitzi Jo Hanknik was the former King County Sheriff. And thanks to voters in Seattle, primarily, they decided that the next sheriff should be picked not by the voters, but by the King County Executive Dow Constantine, with the guidance and support of the far to the left King County Council. Joining me on the line with an exit interview, as it were, is former Sheriff Mitzi Jo Hanknik. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Jason. It's good to hear your voice.
Would you have
and
run?
Nice to be retired.
Yeah, no kidding. You've been talking to me offline just about sort of your life now as in retirement. But would you have run if you were allowed to?
You know, I had planned on running again, and who knows what would have ended up happening. But that was the plan. Certainly, the last 2 years of my 4 years in office went ways that no one could imagine would have happened.
Yeah, no kidding. I mean, you got hit with COVID in that office the same way as everyone else, and you had to deal with the what I call the anti-police bills that were passed by Democrats in Olympia. They call it police reimagining. What has been the impact, in your view, of those laws?
Well, there's been several. I understand the desires of elected officials to try to form legislation that the community wants to see happen or envisions for how they lead their lives and what laws there are. The effect of what I called hasty legislation, and without really considering the aspects of the legislation throughout the state, has had profound impact to law enforcement. And while the King County Sheriff's Office policies were very close to, if not better than some of the legislation that was brought into place in 2021, the hastiness of it has created quite a few problems in trying to manage implementation.
How so?
Or at least did while I was there.
But how so? What are some of the specifics?
Well, there were, you know, gaps in the legislation as it relates to military equipment and mm-hmm. the gauge and caliber of weapons, and, you know, putting individual local governments across the state and having to form opinions and make decisions based upon input from their legal advisors. So it created an inconsistency there. And in my mind, while I was sheriff, the decision to that it disqualified the carrying of less lethal weapons for the sheriff's office, it wasn't going to take that chance for the members of my organization at that time.
Yeah, and you're talking. We talked about it actually earlier this hour. For example, the 40 millimeter, those soft shell rubber bullets, effectively, where last week were not used in the case of a man with a machete in Seattle. And as a result of having to use a canine unit, the dog ends up getting stabbed to death. And they could have used the non-lethal weaponry, even though Adrian Diaz's interim chief has said, we're going to continue to use it. No one believes that their backs will be had if something were to go wrong.
Yeah, exactly that. And then implementation of many other things to include audio and video recording that went into effect on January 1st of this year. The previous legislation, the time in which policies had to be written or adapted and training out to members was so hasty and quickly done. It just creates even more anxiety for members in law enforcement, and so I felt it within the sheriff's office, and certainly I imagine that's continuing today.
Joining me on the line is former King County Sheriff Mitzi Johanknik. We're talking about her time in office now that she's unable to run. No one can run for this particular position. It will be selected by Dow Constantine, the King County executive. How would you characterize your relationship with him?
I don't know that we had much of a relationship that helped coordinate efforts between the two of us. I look at it this way, and what I learned about politics, and, you know, it's particular to my experience, but politicians are about having power. For me, as an elected official, I didn't really consider myself a politician. To do my job, I had to be elected. And so my focus was on the sheriff's office, providing the best services we could, improving things in the sheriff's office and delivery of services. But the power grabs in politics, it's like if you, as a politician, you want more power, and that power has to come from somewhere. I believe in King County government that the elected sheriff's position, which, by the way, wasn't its own branch of government.
Yeah.
The only thing that was separate from the rest of county government was the sheriff position itself. And so any budget proposals I made had to go through the county executive's office, were whittled down there, and then sent forward to the county council for approval. Basically, over the last 2 years of that time, getting cops, additional cops, or budgeted positions through that process wouldn't happen because of the social issues, racial injustice, all of those things that the politicians weren't about, except for a handful of them,
yeah,
to present additions to the sheriff's office. So I don't think they ever really figured me out, Jason. I don't think that the politicians quite understood. I wasn't about trying to gain their acceptance. I was about running the sheriff's office. I have been told by others that they just never could figure me out.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I think. For others, that becomes scary when you're an independent voice, and they're afraid of what that voice may say and actions that person may take in managing the sheriff's office.
But do you think they couldn't figure you out as a person, or did they just have expectations about who you were going to be? Because you and I have talked about this in the past, both on and offline, this idea that you're in law enforcement, but you're a lesbian and a woman, and you're also a Democrat. So you should be doing everything that the Democrats deem necessary, even if it's not in alignment with what's best for a law enforcement agency.
Well, I think you've kind of nailed it. I mean, who I am in my private life, or what my social opinions may be, or my political opinions may be, that can't come into play with what the community is calling for in the delivery of services and my role as sheriff. And so, and I come from 37 years as in my profession, or nearly 37 by the time I finished. And so, you know, those are the complicating factors. being able to make decisions and run a sheriff's office, their inability to trust that a professional in the business could and did adapt, and the sheriffs did adapt, the elected sheriffs did adapt over time to what the needs of the community were. But that still means you need to have a lawful presence. You need to be able to do the work and protect the majority of the community that loves the sheriff's office.
Yeah. We're talking with the former sheriff of King County, Mitzi Johanknik. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment when we come back. You're listening to The Jason Rantz Show. Welcome back to The Jason Rantz Show on AM 770 KTTH. We're going to skip our quick hit today so we can continue our extended conversation with the former sheriff of King County, Mitzi Johanknik, who remains on the line. It kind of seemed like you were in a position, at least in certain circumstances, where you couldn't win. You were damned if you do, you were damned if you didn't. On the one hand, you get hit from the progressive community for not being progressive enough. Then on the other hand, you've had some sort of high-profile instances in which at least members of the King County Sheriff's Office, the boots on the ground, didn't necessarily support some positions you were taking or perceived to have taken. What do you make of that sort of the conflict that was inherent in this job?
I guess I would offer that when you're a leader of a law enforcement agency, in my experience through my time with King County Sheriff's Office, is that you're always that conflict is going to exist. There are decisions you have to make by yourself and you're accountable for. And then there are things that happen and within the organization or outside the organizations that you have to be accountable for too. And you have to make decisions regarding those things when they happen. So whether it's a personnel decision, whether it's a change in a policy decision, you are like many heads of organizations in a position where people aren't going to like you or like your policy or your decision, and there are people who will support it and everything in between.
Was there anything that you thought the public or just, again, the rank and file just got wrong in how they responded to what they perceived had happened?
Sure. I think there are many times law enforcement in particular doesn't publicly speak about things, certainly about investigations while they're in process. And then by the time you do speak about them, time has passed, mm-hmm. and it's not front burner information anymore. It's not important to the public. And there are times when people, you'll find this surprising, Jason, flat out lie.
What?
And yes, I know. And so if anything, that was like a really, really surprising thing for me. Because in law enforcement, you have the highest percentage of people in the business being very truthful and honest about what they do. And what might surprise the community is the people that are not are usually called out by people from within, mm-hmm. and those things are handled, and those things go unnoticed. And so taking appropriate personnel actions and steps go unnoticed. But in the world outside, one of the most surprising things I ran into is when there was, the protests and calls for equity and social justice and making sure that law enforcement was doing their best in our communities, that the turning, if you will, against just the head of organizations, not just myself, but others, and calling for resignations, telling untruths, not even bothering. I found people asking for my resignation, calling for my resignation, who never talked to me.
Yeah.
Never asked me about what was going on, never asked me about what the sheriff's office was doing. And so forth. It was just the thing to be done. If you were running for office, if you were in office, and then, it went from there. So.
Well, you know, obviously there were members of the King County Council that called for your resignation over the years. I believe the last one was Dave Upthegrove. I could be off on that one. But what was the relationship like with the council?
So the relationship with the council was, you know, at the start of my term, started work with them and interact with them, you know, when COVID hit, the timing of COVID and those and folks no longer being in the building, right? So I think that, first of all, probably maybe unlike some others, my staff was spending time working internally in the sheriff's office and doing those things. And from what I've been told, some of the members of the council didn't like the fact that I wasn't, or my staff wasn't spending enough time up on the 12th floor with them, interacting with them. And so this is going to be a longer story for another day, but in essence, surely when COVID hit, they were out of the office, they were telecommuting, everything was being done via you know, electronically.
Mm-hmm.
And so those interpersonal relationships weren't going to be happening, weren't going to, for the last, you know, 2 years of my term, for the most part, folks were out of the building.
Yeah.
You know, so it was an interesting time to try to work through. But again, with all that was going on, the focus and the relationship, you know, didn't maybe develop as much as both sides would want to have happened. But again, you at least expect a phone call from people before they're going to, you know, raise their hand and tell you that you should resign over things and events and information that they had no knowledge about internally and still don't to this day.
But so let's get more specific. Who was so difficult to work with, and who was just, you know, acting from a position of ignorance, basically?
I don't know. I guess, you know, there were members that were easy to work with, who took the time to pick up a phone call, and our staffs took, and there were others that just decided that they were going to take a particular stance on everything that was happening out in our communities during that time.
Like who?
Well, I know you want me to say who. There's a limited number of people on the council, and...
But you know, I imagine who they are. I'm guessing who they are. I'm probably right. But why not just say these are the lawmakers who acted this way? Because that does, I think, help voters figure out who they're going to support the next time they're asked for their vote.
Yeah, I'm not so sure, given the political demographics of this area, that would change anything. Yeah. But what I
they might be heroes.
What I will say is... I'm, you know, this is, I want this exit interview with you, who, you know, one of my favorite broadcasters that you are.
Thank you.
And to say that, you know, it's not about sour grapes for me. It is about the struggles that will continue to happen in local law enforcement, that, you know, just as recently as South End Cities and mm-hmm. the problems we are having with the increase in crime rate and the disregard for law enforcement altogether and not wanting to follow directions, which leads to further problems. And then the hasty implementation of laws and so forth that will continue to impact law enforcement over a period of years. And, you know, so... It's there are opportunities ahead. There are good opportunities for law enforcement ahead. Losing an elected sheriff position and having an independent voice is going to impact King County's overarching law enforcement services that the sheriff's office provides, I believe,
for sure.
The future.
We only have about 2 minutes left. Just very quickly, King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg announced he's not running for re-election. Is that the right move for the county, not having him in office?
I don't know. I think being a prosecutor right now, too, is tough. I know that that Ms. Satterberg's been, you know, in elected office longer than I had, but we both kind of started in, I believe, like the era of 85 and so forth. And sometimes it's just time to let others have an opportunity to do the work. But I will tell you that the continuing thoughts around not enforcing laws on the books and not filing charges leads to problems for our community.
Yeah, 100%. We talked a lot about, in the last couple of weeks, the restorative justice programs, and they're only going to get worse, not better. And it's not to say restorative justice can't work. It can absolutely work for some people. But for others, especially the violent criminals, they don't have a tendency to work. In the minute we have left, what do you look back on and say, this was or these were my greatest accomplishments in office?
I'm proud of a lot of the work. It's just hard right now to reflect back on everything that was done.
Well, the one thing that I can tell you is, especially the officers that have worked for you, that I know that they were very supportive of the fact that you supported them. So it was sort of a mutual sort of relationship of support where you were allowing them to actually do their jobs and you had their backs when they needed it most. Former Sheriff of King County, Mitzi Johanky, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you, Jason. I appreciate your time today.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show.